the fifth kind. Check out our official website at fifthkind.tv.
When you look at things like the Emerald Tablets of Thoth, and you read about ancient Atlantis and how Egypt was created out of the image of Atlantis to create a new civilization. Then you go across the world to places like Tula, Mexico, with these great Atlantean warriors. You start to say, okay, so Atlantis and those individuals that were in Atlantis looks like they influenced Egypt, looks like they influenced some parts of the Americas. We're talking about a grand civilization that seemed to have existed that was completely wiped out. And before that civilization was wiped out by great earth changes and maybe a number of other ways as well, is that they tried to create and essentially protect this knowledge by creating other civilizations around the world. So that's why we try to place the pyramids of Egypt where we do, and then we get to other areas like the pre-Inca, the Olmec, and the Aztec, and the Indus Valley civilizations. And I lump it this way. If there's any advanced, sophisticated building that we find with things that it would exceed the tools that we're told were around during the Iron Age and Bronze Age, then it means that those were from the lost civilizations. That means that there are civilizations around the world that were influenced by similar means that were then all destroyed. They were wiped out. And those are the civilizations that left most of this ancient evidence. But, so how do we place the rest of it? Well, in a tablet called The Legend of Etana, he starts out by stating that when the old world was destroyed, he was basically counseled to create an entirely new civilization in the image of the old world in a place called the city of Kish. And that city still exists today in a ruined state. But he very specifically mentions that he was tasked by the gods to be an archetype of the new world. Not just Kish, not just the town and the region he was part of, but to be an archetype of the entire new world. To redesign and re-lower what they called kingship. To create this structure to a certain way that civilization was supposed to be created based on the way that it was before. So it really brings up the questions of, well, how many times have disasters wiped out and reset this and then it had to be created again and re-lowered through kingship? If you read the Bhagavad Gita and you start looking into Krishna talking to Arjuna about the nature of reality and what the state of our consciousness is within this reality, they clearly talk about how there was a great history that even preceded him and how a lot of that knowledge has been muddied and lost over time. And so he's trying to educate Krishna, this God figure, is trying to educate Arjuna to the old ways and the knowledge of the past. Now, when I take that type of information, those ancient writings that seem to mimic the story of Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, to me, mimics almost in the same way of when we look at the story of Poimander and Hermes, these ancient Hermetic stories. It seems to be the same story. It's this super intelligent God figure being that seems to be having this conversation with an incredibly enlightened and advanced human of some kind that's trying to educate him about the ways of reality. And in every case, it seems like those interactions are always with something that's supreme over our understanding of reality. The other reason why I put the Indus Valley civilizations where I do is not just because of those ancient writings that mimic a lot of other old ancient writings that are in the same time period, but because we find that the structures themselves, whether it's Barbara Hill Caves, Ellora Caves with Kailash Temple, or down in Kanhari Caves, whatever it is, these ancient Indus Valley civilizations that are carved these structures, they were carved into solid basalt. And they're so sophisticated that they mimic in many ways a lot of this other building we find in places like Peru. Now, I have a little tidbit, Paul, that I don't know if you've heard of yet, and I mentioned in a previous one of my presentations. In studying these tablets, there was an ancient Mesopotamian tablet that came up that I think is incredibly important. I don't know if it's got a lot of attention, but it's called Enki in the World Order. And I highly recommend people go to find that. It was actually something that my wife found and shared with me. And then it blew my mind, because what it talks about is, not only does it mention Eridu as his first city ever, so it gives you a little bit of time frame of where it happened, but it mentions how he's having this conversation with this other deity goddess named Inanna. And he says to her, "What are you complaining about? You have all these different regions that you rule over. What do you need more for?" And he lists them off, and he talks about how the regions that are connected through trade and information, direct connections with those cultures. He mentions this region of Dilmun and Maluha in the tablet of with the same age and the time period of Eridu. So we know, and this is Enki speaking to Inanna, we know that this is an ancient writing. And what's so important about that? Well, if you look into where Dilmun is, it is the region of Saudi Arabia, Iran, right through the Persian area. Well, we're not told that that's connected, but it says right in here it was. But even more importantly, he mentions Maluha. And if you look into where that region was, and I'll give a spelling because I might be slightly butchering that name, but it's Muluhha. If you go type that in and find out where that is, it's India. And so it's telling you that in ancient times, all of those cultures were connected, all of them. And that's how you say, okay, that makes so much sense. They had the ancient writings that match. They have the building sophistication that matches the same type of thing. Of course, they were all influenced together. And I think that's how we should be looking at a lot of where these pieces fit in.
It seems to me that the more we actually dig, the larger the scale of the previous civilizations seems to become. I know Anselm Pirambla is doing North America that is showing a previous civilization on a phenomenal scale that connects all the megalithic cultures we know about in South America. Just the scale of it, I think it's kind of frightening for people to think that a global civilization, which is what it looks like, could be extinguished and forgotten. And we don't want to believe that we live on a planet that's that vulnerable. And so without getting too far into conspiracy theories, I think just it's frightening to realize that we're not the first ones here, and that we don't hardly know the first thing about the civilizations that have preceded us. I think that's one of the reasons why people get a little bit nervous talking about these things, our own fragility.
Well, maybe they should get a little nervous, because when we look at these cycles and we look at where we are right now, we have to really ask the question of, well, wait a minute. So why have we seen year after year after year the ancient Inuit saying that the stars have changed position in our sky? And then they're talking about how, well, wait a minute, magnetic north is no longer where it used to be. It's shifting and moving around to different places, and we're having to go up and remap it again. We see earthquakes and I'm not trying to be fear, doom, and gloom. This is just facts. We see more earthquake activity and volcanic activity than we've seen in potentially human history, since records at least began when we were actually writing down that data. We have to start asking questions about whether or not we're in one of those cycles. And I think the real takeaway from that is, can we learn the lessons that are necessary to be able to make it to the next stage of the golden age, as they've called it, of human civilization? Or are we going to also just become a memory of a great military plastic civilization that really polluted its world and didn't really have respect for it, and it was wiped out based on their lack of respect for what they were part of? And I think that the more I look at things, though, right now, to take it the complete other direction, okay, the more I look at things, there's very important things to point out about that so that people aren't afraid. It doesn't mean you shouldn't take it seriously and pay attention and be looking at what's going on around you. But number one, we don't have an ice age right now. That's huge. If you consider that the water on our Earth, we only have a certain amount of water, and if that water is locked up in ice and it melts, it would cause massive problems. And that water doesn't exist in that state anymore. Therefore, that when we look at other aspects like, well, what is all this weird technology that's being used in potentially like Antarctica and the North Pole? Admiral Byrd flying over the North Pole and seeing some weird stuff up there. Have they been using some of this ex-Nazi technology to try to prevent some kind of a disaster secretly? Is that why things like chemtrails are occurring, so they can potentially hide the fact that there are a lot of scary things that are being prevented quietly in the background, so we can keep this thing going without panic and fear from the population? I think that's a really viable thing, and I see a lot of I'm very optimistic. Like you said, there are more young people because of the internet and the way that we are more open-minded in this time period. There are more people researching this than ever before. And so I'm excited the potential of where we could go in the next stage here of our story.
Definitely. It certainly feels like we're in coming into a vulnerable moment in our planet's history. If you read Plato, and if you take his theory seriously, we're long overdue for a reset, because his belief was that it's every 5,000 years or so that something happens to reboot civilization on planet Earth. We seem to have been going for about 10,000 years without a solar flare wiping us out or triggering an ice age or being bombarded by comets or asteroids. Just that timeline itself makes me think, we need to be doing some serious thought right now with regard to our longevity.
Well, and I guess some could even argue that if some of this is somehow more controlled and less random than we think, that maybe this window that we've been given that's longer than others is perhaps because, like the ancients have said, maybe this is the time that we're supposed to reach the next stage, and they weren't really allowed to in some cases. You know, this is the time when humanity is supposed to take the next step forward into the universe and become a truly conscious, eternal being. And, you know, if we had a wipeout right now, that wouldn't happen. We'd have to start over again. So, you know, is that purposeful, right?
Well, Carl Sagan said on many occasions that it's our responsibility to become a spacefaring civilization, because if we don't, then there's a finite timeline on our civilization. And I mean, you couldn't find somebody whose public statements were more grounded than Carl Sagan. And that was his prophetic message to the world.
Yeah, he's a great hero of mine. I think he was one of these rare moments back then where someone who was a public figure was willing to step out of the bounds of their constraints to make people at least think in a much more open-minded way about just the fact that we're in this vast cosmos and what part do we play here? The whole pale dot, I feel like the pale blue dot, and thinking about that in that type of conscious reaction and perspective is one of the most important things that we've lost, that we take so for granted. Because when you think about, and for those who don't know, I'm referring to when one of the last transmissions from one of our probes basically looked back at Earth. We were this tiny little pale blue dot in the surrounded by the darkness of this vast cosmos, which isn't really dark, but it's just our perception of it. And what I think the takeaway of that is, when we look at it from that perspective of consciousness, of what part we play in this vast cosmos, it makes all of this other silliness, this illusion here that binds us by all these things that we're fighting over, and in terms of reality shows and going shopping all the time and thinking that everything's about just looks and money and materialism, it makes everything have to be reevaluated. And it makes us look at everything in a way that I think the ancients looked at things to try to get our perspective right all along.
Definitely. Okay, Matt, take us back to Atrahasis.
Okay, so Atrahasis is probably my favorite cuneiform tablet of all time, because it not only contains an understanding of this time period in terms of when cities were around, but it goes all the way back to talking about mankind's origins, great cataclysms and disasters, and the roles that different gods, these gods they called them, these powerful supreme beings, whatever you want to refer to them as, what role they played within our story. Now, one of the interesting things about what are referred to the Sumerians as the Anunnaki, they've been called many, many names throughout history. I think they're most likely connected to asuras and devas in Hindu mythology, perhaps the jinn in Arabian mythology. We could go on and on and on. Seems like there's an intense competition over what happens in our reality and how our story unfolds and where we go. And it seems like the competition is about, well, if you create a civilization in a certain image you want them, with certain laws and rules and moral code, what will that civilization turn into? And I think it's a great learning lesson, actually, to reflect on ourselves, where just really quick before I go into the Atrahasis, when you look at something like the Roman Empire and you had a situation where money's being used for a massive war front to try to conquer and take over these huge areas. But at home in these capital cities, like in Rome, the people are, you know, there's food is hard to come by. People are starving. They're angry. And so they're acting out. And so what do? They create these great games to not only distract people, but they condition them through violence to have a certain kind of society act a certain way, and then to be reflected in that later on. You saw this time and time again in cities throughout the world, and they weren't always conditioned through violence and fear. But it shows you that that can happen very easily, depending on the type of leadership and the types of rules and laws that are created for that. Well, Atrahasis tells us some really interesting things. He tells us some specifics about when certain things existed and then when they weren't around anymore and they were much older. In Atrahasis, the story of Atrahasis, he is supposedly one of the only individuals who gets out of this catastrophe because he's warned by Enki. And he's only supposedly warned in the story because he had a direct bloodline connection with Enki in this ancestral ancient bloodline of the gods, okay? Now, but he mentions how he's the last of a great line of kings that then essentially after he's gone, or after his story ends, I guess you could say, there's no more like him. And the reason I point that out is in the Epic of Gilgamesh, I feel like the Epic of Gilgamesh might be one of the greatest misunderstood and ignored tablets. People see it as a great poem, and I think they look at the moral lessons that are taught to you through these quests that they go out on. Gilgamesh goes on this great quest to seek, you know, certain things, and he's this hero path. But what it ignores that people don't really pay attention to are some of the specifics that comes up, where Gilgamesh on this great quest, he's seeking immortality specifically. He wants to live forever. And he goes to what seems like in the story a physical place, but the more you read about it, it seems like maybe he was going to some kind of a non-physical place to seek this journey. And what he meets, the whole point of it is he goes to find Atrahasis, who in that story is known as Untupishti. These names that are used for these different individuals changes depending on the different time period in which it's written. These individuals had different names just based on different ages, but if you connect them, you start to say, oh, okay, so Atrahasis is the same individual as the later religious Noah, who's also the same as the flood hero Zayasudra or Untupishti. You say, okay, so that's all the same person. That's once you know that, you start to piece together some really incredible things. And one of my favorite things about in the Epic of Gilgamesh that connects this whole story, it's one of the greatest moments, I think, of realization when you're reading this and you say, oh my God, like there's a clue to this entire lost story that we have. He says in it, Gilgamesh, he seeks out, we'll call him Atrahasis, in because of the timeline, okay? His name is Zayasudra also. He calls him the Flood Hero. And he seeks him because Atrahasis is supposed to be the only historical figure, I'll call them, who had found their immortality and it could live forever. That's what he states. And you're like, well, that's really interesting because he comes from an ancient bloodline, the Sumerian king list, that supposedly could live a really long time. So Gilgamesh finds him. He seeks him out, and this whole story unfolds where he goes across this abyss and he enters this realm where Atrahasis exists. doesn't seem like it's part of our world, because Atrahasis tells him that there were things that occurred long ago that are no longer here anymore. He says, for instance, he tells him a story about when humanity and humans in this age became mortal. He tells him the entire story. He says, basically, there were once gods that walked among us, and those gods departed our world. But he says in a very specific way, he says that when the great deluge came and destroyed everything, the gods were feared it so much, the power of it and what it did, that they left our realm and they disappeared from our direct influence with mankind. And he says specifically something that is amazing to me. He mentions the city of Shurupak. What's so amazing about that is that Atrahasis was the last king of the city of Shurupak, which means that he would know what happened to that city before the flood. But in Gilgamesh mentions that he meets this flood hero, Atrahasis, who then tells him this story of when humans were immortal. And he says that it last occurred in this city of Shurupak. That's when this great divide occurred. But what he says is so interesting is he says, the city of Shurupak, and he specifically mentions that it's so ancient and so old that the gods, like I mentioned, once walked among the men there, and then they departed and left our reality. But what's so mind-blowing about that to me is that when Gilgamesh was around as a giant with this lion sitting on his lap that's the size of a house cat, he's still part of this giant genetics of the gods. This story of Shurupak and Atrahasis and the Sumerian king list and all of this is already ancient. And the other thing that I place the Epic of Gilgamesh here is that on that journey to find Atrahasis, he encounters, and this is how I know it's a non-physical place, he says he encounters the spirit or ghost of Atana. Now, why is that interesting? Well, Atana, if you remember, when I mentioned before, was the story, the cuneiform tablet called The Legend of Atana. He was the king that was created there as the new world architect to create the new world in the image of the gods, this king named Atana. But when Gilgamesh goes on this quest to seek immortality, he meets the spirit of Atana, which means that Atana has already been dead for a great amount of time, and he's already an ancient king. So that's how you can keep placing these things. Okay, so Atana's older than Gilgamesh, and Gilgamesh comes in this later time period, but Gilgamesh is a giant. So it means he had to have been part of a much older story. And this is why, Paul, that I have not two time periods for this, what we think of as the Mesopotamian ancient Sumerians of the area, but I have three. Because the piece of information that I bring in to connect that is this library that I told you about, in the, right when I first started this whole conversation, when I said that Austin Henry Layard had discovered this great library in Mesopotamia, in Nineveh, in 1849, the Ashurbanipal Library. That king, Ashurbanipal, that amassed that library, when you read the writings of him, when he's got these scribes talking about it, he was obsessed with these cuneiform tablets. He felt like the great story of our past and understanding everything could be found in these words. And so what he says in his writings, that it's so mind-blowing to me to try to like place all these in my head on a time scale, is that he states that these tablets, when he was alive, this 4000 BCE, when he was alive, these tablets were so ancient that they had to go find them buried under layers of dirt in some cases in ancient cities that were long ago gone. So that tells you right there that, okay, so Atrahasis, when he digs up the library of Ashurbanipal and he finds the Epic of Gilgamesh, that means that Gilgamesh was much older than Ashurbanipal, because he's finding these tablets that have been in these ancient libraries that have been in temples. So that's how I tried to piece this whole thing together, but it seems like there have been these multiple epics over and over again, and we're just now piecing this incredible story together, Paul.
Absolutely. When we are allowed to gather once again and go to meetings and things, you should be running some retreats where we can just sit at your feet for a whole weekend and decant all this information out of you. Have you got this coming forward in a book in the meanwhile?
Some of this, or a good deal of this, I talk about in my latest book, The Stage of Time. But in terms of going forward with some of this newer information and piecing the whole timeline together, I may be co-writing a book with Billy Carson, which I'm going to try to include this timeline and try to break the whole thing down, because I really do think that when we can piece these events together, we unfold a story that is so much greater and so much more complicated and incredible that just has us understand, well, okay, so we are these sentient beings that seem to be created in the image of these gods that seem to want to create these civilizations. Like, we're created in their image, not the other way around. And that's why we seem, like Lloyd Pye has pointed out, we seem so strange and unusual for this world that we're part of, if it's just purely based on Darwinian evolutionary means with no outside influence. So over and over again, we seem to get this understanding that this is the reason I'm mentioning this, Paul. Some people will be like, why do I care about understanding all this? Like, what does it really do for me, though? What it does is it allows us to understand that we're basically creator gods here that have been made to believe that we are nothing and that we just die and then we turn into the dirt and the soil and then there's nothing else that exists beyond us. But consciousness is an eternal energy. And if we're part of something much greater and that we have the potential to be those creator gods that bring ideas and then turn them into something real and then it allow that to then transform our entire civilization, to then move us forward, that's how we're creator gods here. And I think that by us studying our past and understanding all these ancient stories and these incredible structures that were created, not to have an office building for some company to work in, but to maybe balance the energy of our ley lines of our planet and within the cosmos itself, we can start to reevaluate and look at ourselves and what we're doing here in a completely different light.
That's exactly right. Understanding our origins is all about understanding our potential and who we are and how we can live and to have a far more empowering cosmic vision of who and what we are as human beings. I'm absolutely with you. I'm going to be holding out for that book. I'll be pre-ordering your book with Billy Carson. Keep us posted on that. And in the meantime, how can we keep up with what you're doing?
Yeah, thanks, Paul. I have a YouTube page, Matthew LaCroix, LaCroix. I love to create content. That's one of the things besides an ancient researcher. I really do wish, and I know a lot of people don't know, but I have a full-time job and I try to juggle all this because I love it. It is like the core of who I am and my passion as I feel like the purpose of what I want to contribute here. But so I try to do as much as I can to get all this message out. But the point I'm trying to make is I hope someday I can do this on a full-time level because I love to create videos. I love to give discussions. I would love to go out and, like you said, have retreats in some of these locations and explore them because we should be given this information. This is the most incredible thing that we could uncover because I think it would move us forward basically the next step. And then I just want to also mention my website, thestageoftime.com, has this timeline as well as a lot of the other work that I've done. But it really is an honor to work with someone like you, Paul. I have a lot of respect for the research and the writing you've done.
Matt, thank you so much for being with us again. It's always enjoyable talking to you. We would love to have you back again and just drill down into some more of these moments. But in the meantime, thanks so much for joining us today on The Fifth Kind TV.
Thanks so much, guys. I look forward to the next time.
The Fifth Kind. Click on the links in the description to watch the full video. Check out our official website at fifthkind.tv.